And joining me now on Inside Ivy Hoops is Ivy League Executive Director Robin Harris. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast. How are you?
I'm doing well. Happy New Year, Mike.
Happy New Year to you, too. It's hard to believe. We're already there.
I know.
Already there.
2019, here we are.
And on the precipice of another Ivy League slate, can't wait to jump off into it here. You've been executive director of the Ivy League now for just about a decade, right? Almost a decade. That's
almost a decade. This is my 10th year. Hard to believe.
Yeah.
So quickly, and we've had so many exciting moments in many different sports, and definitely in basketball.
Oh, absolutely. Even just from an Ivy Hoops perspective, there's been an extraordinary amount of developments that have taken place over that span. There was the creation of what was then called the Ivy League Digital Network in 2013. Of course, the launch of the men's and women's tournaments announced in 2016, the media rights partnership with ESPN effective this academic year. Also in 2016, the league named JMI Sports official marketing rights agency, the same agency that has served quote-unquote power conference clients such as Kentucky, Arizona State, the Pac-12. And since then, JMI has reached agreements with for the Ivy with Porsche, Coca-Cola, Nike, Citizens Bank, Under Armour. Is it fair to say that there's been a gradual change of mindset among athletic directors and the Ivy League Council of Presidents about how to market the league in that amount of time?
What has happened is the Ivy League represents the best of college athletics because we demonstrate when we have tremendous athletic success, beating national programs. I mean, just in December, we had multiple top 20 wins on the men's and the women's side. And when we do that, when we win in the basketball tournament, when we succeed nationally, we demonstrate that you can have outstanding academics, you can have true student athletes, and you can operate consistent with your principles and still be successful athletically. And in doing that, then these opportunities come to us, and it's actually fits within our model and our philosophy and our principles. And we still operate the same way we always have. So we haven't changed our scheduling. We don't, even with the opportunity for national television exposure, we might move games around a little bit, but you're not going to see us all suddenly playing games midweek just to get a television window. We might move a game time, we might move a game within a weekend, but we're not going to sacrifice our students' ability to get to class television. So all these things fit together. In terms of having sponsorships, we look for brands that relate well to our constituent groups and that represent quality and excellence and attributes that we aspire to as well. So it all fits together. And as far as the tournaments, that was a bit of an evolution among the athletic directors. It was also a recognition of the improvement, frankly, in the quality of basketball from top to bottom. So our league is so much more competitive from top to bottom than traditional. And I have no idea who our four teams are going to be on the men or women's side when we get to the Ivy Madness in March. And that is incredibly exciting. And it adds tremendous value to our regular season because the fight for those last few spots is just exhilarating and exciting for all the teams.
Yeah, it exhilarating is a good word for it. Exciting is another good word for it. Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
I do I think it's worth noting and expounding upon what you alluded to there about Ivy League, meaning connoting high achievement beyond just a sports context, which is very rare in the NCAA landscape. It's not as if when most people think of Harvard, they think of Tommy Amaker or Harvard basketball, those, you know, which also some high achievement there, but there's so much more at Harvard or any Ivy than just basketball. I do know, I guess there's an age-old conflict between preserving the amateurism, perhaps the highest achieving group of schools in the country, and securing the economic resources they need to succeed and give their players the platform they work so hard to deserve. I know that there's a contingent of fans, Ivy League basketball fans, are a bit uncomfortable with the league's embrace and some of the member schools' embrace of corporate sponsorship, Penn Athletics selling the Plester Courts naming rights to Macquarie didn't sit well with some, for example. And then the Ivy League's been historically very different from most athletic conferences, again, in that people really do associate the Ivy with superior academics first and foremost, rather than, you know, heavily sponsored brand name programming. Do you think there's such a thing as too big when it comes to quantity of exposure or corporate sponsorships in Ivy athletics, particularly since the product on the basketball end, in particular, has become so remarkably stronger in recent years?
Well, first of all, nothing has changed in terms of how we evaluate priorities. And the academics and the student-athlete experience as students comes first. Athletics is an important part of their educational experience on our campuses, and so that's there as well. The opportunity to bring in some corporate partners who can provide some of the funding that helps to provide these wonderful athletic experiences for our student athletes and, frankly, for the campus community, but for the student athletes, is a tremendous opportunity that helps to offset some of the costs that our campuses and our office incurs in putting on the various events and providing these opportunities in even producing the events for the Ivy League Network, which is now on ESPN. Our schools are producing a lot of the events, the vast majority of events. And so any funding that we are able to get helps to contribute to that. It's not a revenue producing model. So there's a huge difference, although there's similarities. It's very different from what you might see at other schools.
Right. To that end, how will the league go about determining whether its media rights partnership with ESPN is successful over the lifespan of that 10-year agreement? And how successful has it proven to be already?
I'm really glad you asked about that because it's been incredibly successful. The transition, I had very high expectations for our partnership. I figured there'd be some bumps in the road as we transitioned. I have to tell you, it's gone incredibly smoothly. The entire transition to the new platform, we have over 1,100, approaching 1,300 events that are going to be available on ESPN Plus this year. And we have been able, through this agreement, to offer enhanced exposure for all of our sports through our agreement with ESPN, and that includes, obviously, men's and women's basketball. We've also enhanced the what we would call linear or traditional television exposure by being on ESPN linear platforms with 7 Ivy League basketball games and a game of the week for women's basketball on ESPN3, which is significantly higher than we've had in previous years. So all of our games right now are not only on a wider, available to a wider general group of fans, but we also are able to broadcast our games on a venue that prospective student athletes and their families, our alumni, can have access to in a much easier way. And the price to subscribe to ESPN Plus is actually less expensive than it used to be to subscribe to the Ivy League Network. And you get more content when you subscribe. So we've, I think our fans, I've only heard positive reaction. In addition, we know from this fall that over 1 million people watched Ivy League football on ESPN this past season across all the platforms. And that viewership and ratings are incredibly surpass what we experienced in prior years, where we had terrific television packages, but we know we're ahead of where we've been. So already the success has been terrific, and we expect it to continue, and we'll continue to pay attention to viewership numbers and metrics. But so far, based on the feedback we're hearing, this has been an unqualified success.
Well, that's terrific that there are tangible benchmarks that are already being surpassed, because in the case of Ivy League basketball, having a platform to accentuate and really just provide visibility for the strength of the league is really, it's really something, because the strength of the league for the past few seasons now, but this season in particular actually has really been something to marvel at. On the women's side, Harvard on Sunday upset 14th ranked Cal, first win over a ranked opponent since making
on Cal's home court, by the way.
Yes, that's right. That's worth noting. You're right. Since making history by upsetting one seed Stanford in the opening round of the 1998 NCAA tournament. In fact, Katie Benson was named ESPNW's Player of the Week New Year's Eve after that win. There's a lot of promising young talent league-wide, including Yale's Camilla Emsbo, three Rookie of the Week awards, and Columbia's Sienna Durr with two, plus a Player of the Week award overall. On the men's side, Princeton isn't alone when it comes to scoring upsets this season. Harvard won at St. Mary's. Yale and Penn beat Miami consecutively in a three-day span last month. Penn toppled Villanova at the Palestra, of course. Brown exploded with scorching hot shooting and a win at San Diego State Saturday. And what was thought to be the league's lower tier has acquitted itself well in non-conference play, too. Dartmouth almost pulled off a huge upset at Davidson. Cornell hung tough and actually led well into the second half at Syracuse. And Columbia took Rutgers to overtime. The upshot of all of that is that the Ivy League has a higher conference rating now per KenPom than it has ever finished a season with, dating back to the 2001-2002 season. Currently neck and neck with the Missouri Valley Conference, which had a Final Four team last season. What do you think is driving this trend of Ivy League basketball continuing to get better relative to other conferences, not just this season, but in recent years?
Yeah, that's a terrific question, because it has definitely been an overall upward trajectory, both for the men and for the women. And as you talk about our terrific success so far this year, it really has, or not this year, season, since we're just into January, it has been a truly phenomenal non-conference season for both the men and the women. They're both guaranteed as a group to finish over 500, and that is with teams challenging themselves and playing a huge number of difficult games on the road. And so to come through it with a winning non-conference record at this point in the season, with some huge wins and overranked teams, as you've noted, really represents the trajectory that we've been on. Why has that been happening? It's a variety of reasons, and it has to do with our programs hiring terrific coaches who embrace the being in the Ivy League and providing an incredible student-athlete experience. And so they go out and they find individuals that also want that unrivaled experience of being at the pinnacle of athletics and academic opportunity, and having an experience over 4 years generally that set you up for the rest of your life. So our coaches talk about this is not just a four-year decision. It's a lifelong or 40 or 50-year decision. And so as we are able to have success and show the success and the ability to win games in the NCAA tournament, the women several years ago, we had multiple teams in the NCAA tournament. I think that's going to happen for the men as well at some point. And so as we show that we're a potential multiple bid Ivy League, you can go deep into the NCAA tournament, you can have success, and you're prepared for your career when you graduate, it feeds upon itself. And we have schools that have incredibly generous financial aid packaging for that's need-based. And it's awarded based solely on need, so athletic ability is not factored in. But the fact is, if you have financial need and you want to get a good education, you can come to an Ivy League school. And that has and I think more individuals are aware of that. And that has opened up doors for more and more individuals across all sports and across our entire campuses, not just athletes, obviously. But all of that feeds into wonderful synergy. As you know, there's a saying, a rising tide rises all boats. So as different programs have shown that they can be successful within the Ivy League, other programs see that and they recruit and they develop programs that also are succeeding. And we're really, you're right, we're seeing the fruits of that from top to bottom in a way that we haven't seen in some time this year. I think it's going to continue, and it's not a surprise because we've seen the building of it over the past, at least during my tenure, but it started before I got here.
Yes, something heartening that I've noticed so far this season is that the Ivy Women's Hoops Week in Review posts that our fantastic staff writer Rob Brown writes have been getting just as much hits, sometimes more, as our posts about Ivy Men's Hoops. I remember when I was a senior sports editor at the Daily Pennsylvanian, I started live blogs of Penn women's basketball games because we already live blogged the men's games. But the women's games would get very few followers and comments, really a tiny fraction of those that customarily came with men's basketball games. So I'm happy to note on the podcast here that Ivy Women's Basketball, which, as you noted, has already achieved the hashtag two-bit Ivy that that the men's side is still, you know, still looking to achieve and probably will if the NCAA selection committee maybe undergoes some changes here in recent years or in future years rather. But the bottom line is Ivy Women's Basketball does have a following, does garner significant interest, and well, it should, obviously, given how strong it is. What's the league's strategy as to how it promotes Ivy Women's Basketball? You noted the game of the week on ESPN3, which is very significant and beyond what had been there in previous media rights agreements for the league. The league is now, on the women's side, it's expected to be one of the top 10 leagues in the country every season now, but many fans still rue the fact that women's basketball often doesn't garner as much coverage or attention. So how does the league try to go about elevating the platform of Ivy Women's Basketball beyond just the ESPN agreement?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And so I will start by saying that our staff, we have staff that cover basketball, and we have one person who primarily covers men's basketball during the season, and we have one person who primarily covers women's basketball in the season. And they really focus on providing very equivalent content on social media, our weekly releases, and promoting the wonderful success stories of our student athletes. And so our awards program is identical, obviously. And so we're promoting the stories, and we, from our office, are treating them the same. that doesn't mean, to your point, that people are necessarily clicking the same. So it's up to us to find ways to engage with our fans and to pay attention to what does, in fact, cause the best engagement, what leads to the engagement. And so our staff has done a great job, particularly on social media, in figuring out the photos, the videos, the hashtags, or the headlines that they include in their materials to drive that engagement. So that's one way, treating the men and women the same and making sure they're getting equitable coverage. The ESPN relationship also goes beyond the live games and providing an incredible platform on ESPN3 as well as ESPN Plus. So it's easier to find the games than it used to be. But it's also our relationship by being in the ESPN ecosystem, our ability to get plays on, for example, SportsCenter Top 10. We have a direct access to put plays that truly warrant consideration into the hands of the producers who are working on that, and that has shown success over time. We also really focus on marketing Ivy League basketball and in building the brand. This year, we just launched yesterday a weekly podcast that will discuss every week, 12 episodes leading up to Ivy Madness, men's and women's basketball with three very well-respected and knowledgeable individuals in Bill Spalding, Noah Savage, and Megan Perry. And Noah graduated from Princeton, was a men's basketball player, and Megan was a Cornell women's basketball player. And so their discussion, we're hoping this really, I listened to the first episode last night, and I can't wait for the next one. It was so exciting, and it actually had to be recorded before two of our upsets happened. And that's how quickly things can change. And so next week's episode is going to talk about that. And even without two of the upsets that happened being included in the show, they still were able to, we've had so much success this year. And on the men's and women's side, I mean, Princeton, one of the games that I don't think you mentioned was Princeton beating Quinnipiac, a team that won a game or two in the NCAA tournament the past several years. And Princeton's now healthy. So we want to promote how their success and the success overall of our programs that with the women guaranteed a winning record. And being able to do that through this podcast, through additional other creative content that we put on IvyLeague.com. Our staff has worked really hard to transform IvyLeague.com and make it a destination for fans that want to follow Ivy League sports generally. So our standings page is updated on a weekly basis during the season. It'll be updated every night. And it also includes stories right away. So when Harvard beat Cal, there was a story up that night. When Princeton beat Arizona State, a story up that night. So we are working hard to make IvyLeague.com a destination. And then one piece that's not public-facing that a lot of people probably don't realize is that the NCAA has set up a structure with the men's and women's basketball selection committees where every conference is assigned two individuals on the committee who reach out to us throughout the season. And we talk to them probably half a dozen times throughout the season about our team. So we have two reps on the men's committee and two representatives on the women's committee. And our role is to provide additional context and explanation regarding how our teams are doing beyond the one loss record. So we can explain when there's an injury and someone's come back or any circumstances that might be going on. I always find it helpful, for example, to explain to our committee representatives who don't know about our travel partner and back-to-back schedules how our teams are playing Friday, Saturday for 6 weeks. And they need to understand that whoever comes through that gauntlet of games is a real champion in a way that's very different from other conferences where you get a break between your Friday, Saturday game. And I also explain about the travel between Columbia and Cornell and how that's challenging. And playing our teams we have such a balanced schedule. So our teams really get to know each other, and that's more challenging than a traditional conference schedule, particularly in the day and age where you have conferences so large they can't play double round robins anymore. So providing that context to our NCAA committee representatives has been helpful over the years in, I think, helping the committee feed our teams appropriately most years. Not all years, though, I will say that.
Well, no, I think Ivy fans that don't know about that interfacing with the selection committees will be happy to know that, or to at least get a little bit of reassurance from that. Since you mentioned it, to what extent have there been discussions about having Ivy games on Friday and Sunday, or changing up the weekend back-to-backs during the conference season? At least a couple of coaches have come down vocally for and against tinkering with that recently.
Yeah, you know, occasionally an individual or two will say, have we ever thought about trying to look at our schedule and doing things differently? And nothing in particular has taken root at any point in time. There is, you know, certainly the commitment to minimizing missed class is going to be paramount. And also the travel involved. So there's complications with every model that you look at and unintended consequences as you shift things around. So for now, we are definitely in the model we're in. We also have right now, as I think people are aware, that traditionally the Ivy League schools had exams in January. Many of our schools did that. And Princeton is the last one to do so. Well, we don't allow a school to play during their exam period, a regular season game. And so that having exams during January is why the Ivy League schedule starts as late as it does compared to other conferences. And Princeton is in several years going to be changing their exam schedule. So we may look at our basketball schedule as we get a better handle on what Princeton's exam schedule is going to be, because then it means that all exams will be done in December. And it could give us flexibility, but I couldn't even begin to predict what that would look like if we were to change anything. I could tell you that we're not going to increase missed class time.
Certainly makes sense. Yeah, the Ivy League tournament, keeping in the vein of looking at how things could be tinkered, obviously it's definitely been a thrilling capstone, if controversial for some, to the conference slate for both the men and the women the past two seasons. This season, of course, it'll be held at the John J. Lee Amphitheater at Payne Whitney Gym. The league noted back in May that the site for the 2020 tournaments will be determined later as the league continues to explore various options. Is the goal to eventually get to a point where the league isn't exploring options on a year-to-year basis, where instead you've got an understood venue rotation or a seating arrangement perhaps that the league sticks to every season?
We have talked about having a multi-year plan, and we've explored different options with the athletic directors about what that could look like. And because the tournaments are so young, we want to take advantage of benefiting from our experience and be able to be nimble in understanding how each year goes as we select the next year. So in the long term, it would be great to, you know, for the events, the individuals that are responsible for putting on the event, yes, they want to know as many years in advance as they can. For those of us responsible for ensuring we're providing the best experience possible, we want to make sure we have as much information as possible as we make these decisions. So it's always a balance in how far ahead can we be, And we have to continue assessing that as the tournaments get longer legs, as they grow and develop, then we might be able to get further out ahead. We're still learning, and one of the things that the athletic directors noted when they agreed to propose the tournaments to the presidents was that we could be flexible and adapt as we learned new things. So we don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves and committed to something for too long in case we want to make changes. Because we really want to provide our student athletes and our fans with the best experience possible.
Right. I do know a lot of Ivy fans were surprised that Lee Amphitheater was chosen to host this year's tournaments. It's a fantastic venue. One of the Ivy's finest, I think, but it does have a listed capacity of only 2,800 seats, 1,500 permanent, 1,300 pull-out bleachers, and the combined attendance for the two title games last season at the Palestra was more than 5,500. Are you concerned that some would-be tourney attendees are going to be turned away due to lack of room?
The people should be buying tickets now. Tickets are on sale at ivymadness.com. It's going to be an incredibly popular event, and we think it's going to be a sellout. And will some people find out that they can't get tickets at the last minute? Yes, that is going to be the case. So we want to get the word out that you should get your tickets now.
And that's on a...
It is a terrific venue. It's going to have an incredible atmosphere and be a wonderful, wonderful event. And we're really excited to be moving the tournament to a new area of our footprint and to have tremendous crowds for all of our games, all six games. We expect sellouts.
Do you think that any Ivy arena could feasibly host the tournaments?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. All our venues are fully, and staffs are capable of hosting.
How do you think it benefits Ivy women's basketball to combine both the men's and women's tournaments, which is something that you've stressed as a priority, and it's now happening with the men's and women's lacrosse tournaments this May as well?
Yeah, we are combining the men's and women's lacrosse tournaments in May. It happens to be the 10th anniversary of the men's and women's lacrosse tournaments, which provides a nice opportunity to combine them. As people may know, Columbia does not sponsor men's lacrosse, so Columbia provided a neutral site opportunity for the men's tournament, and having a predetermined site went really well last year, particularly with our ability to engage with some of the youth teams in New York City and some of the inner city rec leagues. And we wanted to provide that same opportunity for the women. The women's coaches were unanimous in wanting to see how that works. So we're really excited about that in New York in the first weekend in May to have our men and women together there for the lacrosse tournament. And frankly, part of the emphasis behind that was it's worked really well with basketball. Having the men and women together has created a tremendous synergy and a one Ivy feeling that weekend. It's also helped with media coverage. And it's frankly helped with ESPN coverage as well in terms of the broadcast windows and having the women's semifinals on ESPN3 and the women's championship game on ESPNU, having that at the same venue as the men provided a cost saving for ESPN and allowed us to secure better coverage for the women live games. We also saw better media coverage at press conferences and the women's games because the media was already there. There's a good synergy there, and it helps our schools when they have multiple teams because everyone can be in one place and you're not trying to split and go to different locations in terms of fans as well as other individuals from the university. So it's really been a wonderful synergy. And we have seen fans who will, of one gender, decide to stay for the games or come early to the games of the other gender. And we expect that that will continue.
Well, that's good. I mean, I know Ivy followers have pointed out that, you know, having the highest seeds of each gender host would, you know, eliminate the competitive disadvantage argument and, you know, obviously keep it from going to a neutral site as well and cost incurred there. But from a planning perspective, I can see how that would be a little bit unwieldy and kind of eliminate the all the benefits you just outlined. I wanted to just close out by asking you very broadly, given everything that we've covered here, what makes you most excited about the future of Ivy League basketball going forward?
I think it's our upward trajectory in terms of the success of our teams generally, our student athletes when they're at our schools and when they go out into the real world and in their careers. And the fact that we're able to have these successes and still be consistent with our founding principles and values and providing our student athletes an incredible experience while they're in school as students. And to me, the fact that we can have it all is what makes me incredibly excited to continue to work with our great 8 institutions and work with the Ivy League to continue to promote our wonderful student athletes.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so very much for coming on the podcast, especially since, as you noted, the league has its own. and that one, new episodes will be available each Wednesday, ivyleague.com and Apple Podcasts. I covered a lot of ground. Anything else you'd like to add?
Mike, I think you've covered so much. And I appreciate your in-depth knowledge and your passion for Ivy League, the Ivy League generally, as well as, of course, basketball, and for all that you do to help what we're trying to do as well. I really appreciate that.
Well, as I told you before we started recording, it's a labor of love on our end, our staff's end, and we appreciate how the league seems to be operating from a position of strength, certainly in terms of on the court success right now, and that's a thrill for anyone involved. So we appreciate it. Robin Harris, thank you so very much for coming on Inside Ivy Hoops, and enjoy what is certainly promising to be a fantastic Ivy League basketball season.
Thanks so much, Mike.